All right. This is Adam Chile, PhD candidate in the History Department, and I'm here in the office of Karl Kreutz, professor in the Climate Change Institute, and we're here to talk about his experiences with CCI. So just to get us started, could you tell me a little bit about how you came to be interested in climate science?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to childhood, if you will, of being outside and interested in outdoor recreation, growing up in a family that valued, the outdoors. And I can't say I was that interested in climate or climate science back then, but I was interested in, nature and the outdoors, and have had a long fascination with winter and winter landscapes and skiing. So as an undergraduate, I kind of gravitated to that and happened to be, when I did my undergraduate degree, I did it at the University of Buffalo, and there happened to be a professor there who I took a class in glacial geology from. And that really opened my eyes to climate change, glaciers in the landscape as really not only from a recreational standpoint, but also from a science and possibly career standpoint. And so, as it turns out, that professor, his name was Parker Calkin. Do you want me to go on and on about?
Sure.
So this is sort of my first linkage to the Institute. So Parker Calkin was a colleague of Hal Bourne's and George Denton. So if you go downstairs, when you come in the front door downstairs, there's a picture, the original sort of picture of the Institute, some of the members of the Institute. Parker Calkin is in there with George Denton and Hal Bourne. So those three go way back. And so I took a class in glacial geology from Parker Calkin, which really, like I said, sort of opened my eyes to this broad field of science as being something that really interested me a lot. And so one thing led to another, and I ended up coming here to the Institute to do my master's degree with Hal Bourne's, primarily, again, because of the connection that Parker Calkin, my undergraduate professor, had with the Institute. And so, yeah, that was my first, so I was here I did my master's degree.
And Hal Bourne's was your thesis?
Yeah, he was my advisor.
Okay.
And so, through Hal, and I got to work with George Denton and George Jacobson, and, sort of this was in the early, I did my master's degree from 92 to 94. Mm-hmm. So, my sort of the core group of Institute faculty, that are here today, many of them were here back then too. So I've got a history with that part of the Institute going back to the early 90s. So I did my master's degree here. I left here, went down to the University of New Hampshire, did my PhD down there. When I was here at the Institute, I did my master's degree here in this lab that we're sitting in right now, the Stable Isotope Laboratory. So I learned the geochemical techniques of isotope geochemistry while I was here. I went down to the University of New Hampshire, sort of expanded my use of geochemistry as a way to study climate and climate history. When I was at UNH, I got into using ice cores as a tool for climate, studying past climate change. And then from UNH, I went and did a postdoc at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And so, so ever since I left the Institute, I maintained a, pretty strong connection with it. And so then when I was finishing my postdoc at Woods Hole, it so happened that our faculty position here was open to to be in the institute and also to run the stable isotope laboratory. So long story short, there too, I came back. Mm-hmm. You know,
that you were a natural pick for them because they knew you had experience working in that lab.
I don't know. You'd have to tease that out of them, but they offered me the job. So mm-hmm. Yeah. Obviously, I mean, I had a connection. I knew the lab. I'd worked here before. I knew Doug Intro, who's the technician who built this laboratory in the late 1980s, and who has run it ever since. I have had a long relationship with him as well. So
yeah,
in lots of ways, I was probably a natural fit to come back and do this. So.
So, can you, for the listeners who may not be familiar with the technicalities of this,
yep.
Can you explain in simple terms the role stable isotopes plays in your own research?
Sure. So, if you look at the periodic table of the elements, so all of the different chemical elements that make up matter as we know it. Many of those elements, things like that we're familiar with, like carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, many of those different elements essentially come in different flavors. And when I say flavors, I mean they actually, if you take a particular atom of hydrogen, for example, not all hydrogen atoms are exactly the same. Some of them have different weights. And we call those atoms of hydrogen with different weights, isotopes of hydrogen. So there's some hydrogen that has an atomic mass of 1, there's some hydrogen that has atomic mass of 2. And so you can, because the same atoms of the same element will weigh slightly differently, they behave differently in nature. And so what we do is we use that weight difference to our advantage when we're studying the environment. So what we do here in our laboratory, our stable isotope laboratory, is we take the material we work with most often is water. So we take water, and in our lab we can look at the individual molecules of H2O, and we can measure the hydrogen and we can measure the oxygen in those water molecules, and essentially tell you how much of those different isotopes of hydrogen and oxygen are in each water molecule. And so what we do with that information is it turns out that if you look at water and the way that it moves through the environment, water molecules will get separated during when water is evaporating and condensing in the hydrologic cycle, because different water molecules have different weights because of their isotopes. Water will get separated based on its isotopic composition. And so the degree to which water gets separated often is a function of temperature. So what we do in our laboratory is we look at the stable isotope makeup of water, and we can look, by doing that, we can learn something about what the temperature conditions were like as the water was moving through the hydrologic cycle. Now, practically speaking, for our institute, much of the research that goes on in the institute is interested in paleoclimate, so past climate change. So when we go to places like Greenland and Antarctica and we drill ice cores down from the surface of the ice sheet all the way down to the bottom, an ice core record from those kind of places can contain samples of snow and ice that go back hundreds of thousands of years. So what we do is we take the ice from these ice cores, bring it back here to the laboratory, you melt it, you get water. We measure the water here in the isotope laboratory, and so we can learn by looking at the isotopic composition of the water, we can tell you something about what the temperature in the atmosphere was, let's say 400,000 years ago. So that's the basis of the tool that we use, one of the tools that we use here, to look at past climate change.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the different places where you've done research?
Sure. Well, I got started in my graduate work. Actually, when I was here as a, in the Institute as a master's student, I did my research here in Maine. So I worked in down east Maine, again, because Hal Borns was my advisor. Hal had done a lot of work on the glacial history of down east Maine, so looking at the way that the last great ice sheet that was here in North America, how it retreated through down east Maine around about 14,000 years ago. And so I, being his student, I was working out there as part of that overall problem, studying the retreat of the last ice sheet through here during the end of the last ice age. So from there, when I went down to University of New Hampshire, I had the chance to work, do my research down in Antarctica. So I spent several seasons working down in Antarctica, and that's where I had the opportunity to start using ice cores as a way of reconstructing past climate change. Let's see, then from Antarctica, so that started my work in Antarctica, and I've maintained that sort of research thread, I guess if you will, ever since then. So I continue to work down in Antarctica. Let's see, after that, I had the chance to go over and work in Asia quite a bit. So I've spent several seasons over in Asia, working up in the high mountains of, many of the mountain ranges that surround the Tibetan Plateau. So Nepal up through Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, sort of the western side of China. I mean, that whole area is surrounded by big mountain ranges. So I've worked in many places throughout Asia, again, looking at trying to collect ice cores and reconstruct past climate change in that area. I've done the same thing in most of the mountain ranges now that are in the surround the North Pacific, so the northeastern North Pacific, so Alaska, coastal Yukon territories, British Columbia, Central Alaska. So there's a lot of big mountains up there. Many of the mountain ranges are glaciated with big glaciers. So I've worked throughout that general region, mostly drilling ice cores and doing all the science that goes. I mean, it's not just ice cores, but all the science that goes along with it. Let's see. I've had the chance to work in Greenland quite a bit, both with the ice cores recovered from Greenland and down in coastal Greenland, on the looking at the change in ocean conditions down in coastal Greenland. And let's see, I've worked a little bit down in South America, not much, but a little bit. I guess that's about it.
Yeah, that's about it.
Yeah, that's about it. A lot of work. A lot of work in Antarctica, and now up in, as I stare at the map, up in Alaska. So,
So, for example, when you were in Antarctica and traversing over places that few humans had ever seen, did you see yourself as a kind of explorer?
Not particularly. No, not really. I've never really considered my... I mean, you can think yes, sometimes you stop and think, wow, especially in Antarctica, wow, you know, it probably... There's a good chance that no one has ever stepped foot here. When I think of explorers, I think of... I don't know. I tend not to think of scientists. I tend to think of... people who are out pushing the envelope just because they can or because they want to. I think scientists are usually out there. They have a different purpose in mind, and so that's usually, to me, when I'm in those areas, I mean, that's at the forefront, is you know, the science, and it's a job. That's the job we have to do. I'm not out there. My job is not to be out there trying to be an explorer, my job is to be out there as a scientist. And so I guess I look at it differently. Even though, yeah, I mean, places in Antarctica, like for, I guess in particular, you do, in pursuit of your science, end up in areas that, yeah, I mean, are incredibly remote and likely never seen by either anyone or surely very few people. So the science does bring you into some really remote and incredible places, but I don't know. I don't think of myself as being an explorer out there.
Okay.
I think of myself as being a scientist, you know, in a very remote place. So if I wanted to be an explorer, I probably wouldn't be doing science. I'd be out, you know, skiing around just to ski around. So, yeah.
How do you think research in Antarctica has changed from when Hal Bourne was your age doing research in Antarctica and now?
Yeah. Well, I think probably in a lot of important ways, it's the same. I mean, people have broad ideas about how the Antarctica, Antarctica, how the climate system impacts Antarctica, and then vice versa, how Antarctica influences the climate system, and go down there with go to Antarctica with big science ideas in mind, and are out there trying to solve them. So I think, you know, in many ways, the underlying principles haven't really changed at all. Certainly what has changed, even the time from when I first went down there in the mid-1990s until now, I mean, of course, technology is vastly different, particularly communications. I mean, I know when Hal and his colleagues were going down there in the late 50s and 60s, I mean, you know, once they left here, they were out of touch for months probably. Whereas now, when you go down there, you're in constant contact. Even if you're, you know, the most remote place you can think of, you still have satellite phones and satellite communication. And so that's changed dramatically. You know, the mode of transport, of course, is much different. I mean, these days, when you go down to Antarctica, they can fly you anywhere on the continent. Whereas back then, you know, it was much more difficult to get around. But now, it's really just a matter of, you know, pointing to a map and saying, I want to go there, and they'll get you there. So things have definitely changed in that regard. I imagine, although I wasn't around back then, I imagine the bureaucracy of Antarctica has changed quite a bit. I mean, there's a lot of doing research in Antarctica these days involves a lot of I have the sense that back in the 50s and 60s, it was much more of a, I don't know, kind of the Wild West sort of thing. I mean, a lot of people just making things happen, where now there's paperwork and agencies and, you know, a lot of hoops to jump through. And so I think that has changed dramatically. And what I've seen down in Antarctica is, I think the research infrastructure that exists in Antarctica oftentimes these days, I think, it allows people to go down to, researchers to go down to Antarctica, perhaps not as prepared as they would have been a long time ago, when the burden of things was on the researcher much more. For example, you know, going off into the middle of nowhere, you know, back in Hal's day, you know, you had to have your stuff together to go out into a very remote place, because you knew that nobody was going to come and get you or support you, or you were on your own out there. Whereas now, with communications being what they are and transport being what they are, and the ability to move people and material back and forth to Antarctica, like the Antarctic program can. I think people, not everybody, but some people, some researchers have a much different perspective on what it means to be working in a place like that, in a very a remote setting. I think the perception of how prepared you need to be down there has probably changed. Mm-hmm. You know, I forgot, you know, geez, I'm out in the middle of nowhere and I forgot a nut and a washer, and you get on the phone and say, can you deliver this to me? And they do. So it was different back in the 50s, where once you were out there, that was it. Mm-hmm. So
despite the improvements and the changed character of Antarctic research, can you think of some major difficulties you encountered during your trips down there?
The weather. The weather is still the same. I mean, the same in the sense that the weather still dictates, you know, despite all the advances in communications and technology, transport, the weather is still the weather down there. So, can be very difficult. You know, it doesn't matter what kind of plane or helicopter or whatever you have. I mean, if the weather's bad, you can't do anything. So, the weather... Yeah, the weather is a big challenge down there, it dictates a lot of what you can or can't do, and field seasons even you know today can be made or broken based on the weather for that particular season. Particularly if you're working out in a very remote remote. So, I mean, there's Antarctica, even though it's a big continent, I mean, some places are very remote and some places are less remote. I mean, if you're working near one of the bases, transportation will be easier. But if you're working way out in the what they call the deep field down there, you know, bad weather can really be a major problem. So that's, you know, that's always an issue and still is an issue and a big challenge. Probably the biggest challenge down there.
How many times have you been to Antarctica?
I've been six times.
Six times?
Yeah.
And what was the longest stint?
Probably about, I guess just about 2 months.
2 months.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about what are the everyday conditions like, for example, your sleeping arrangements?
It's different depending on it's different depending on the situation. So sometimes when I've some years in Antarctica, I've been in established camps where, you know, there could be anywhere from 30 to maybe 50 people. At one of the, even though you're in the what they call the deep field, a remote field camp, it's still a fairly large camp. And so in that case, day-to-day, you know, living is in large, they call them James Way huts, but, you know, large tents that, and there's a kitchen staff, and there's, you know, there's logistics folks in addition to scientists. So there's a big sort of group effort going into the camp. So in that case, you know, you're sleeping in fairly comfortable quarters, and you have, you know, hot water and kitchen and meals prepared for you and everything. So that's for me in my time down there, that's sort of been the one extreme. The other extreme is our small camps, 4 to 5 people, you know, still out in the deep field, but a much more self-sufficient group, living in what we call Scott tents, which are tents that the design comes right down from, you know, Captain Robert Falcon Scott back in the early 1900s. It's a pyramid tent that's really the design of which has proven really well suited for the Antarctic environment. So we still use those Scott tents. So, you know, some seasons I've been down there, our camps have been, you know, 2 or 3 of the 4 to 5 people, a couple of those Scott tents, living, cooking, everything out of those tents, and doing our science, you know, in a very small camp. That's the situation I prefer. I like that. It's much more. I just like that type of setup much better.
It feels what? Less structured, less controlled.
Just more self-sufficient, I think. I mean, there's nothing wrong with the. I mean, the big camps are comfortable, I don't know, something about a small camp makes it feel truer to the. Makes it feel like a truer Antarctic experience when you're down there, and you look around, and you know, pretty much in all directions, all you see is the Antarctica, the ice sheet, the mountains, what have you, wherever you are, as opposed to seeing piles of cargo and, you know, bulldozers and airplane landing strips and things like that. So anyway, yeah, I mean, it's neither good nor bad either way, but I've always enjoyed the seasons down there when we were in a small camp, doing our science with a small group. And you form, you know, it's not just about the environment, but it's also about, you know, the people you're working with. When you have a small core group of people that you know well, that you spend, you know, a month and a half with, working on some science project. I mean, that's a much different social experience than when you're in a big camp of 40 or 50 people. So. So yeah, if I had my preference, that's what I'd do. Yeah. And most often that's what I've done, not just in Antarctica. But when we've worked in the mountain regions throughout the world, you know, that small camp approach is how I've most often done things. So it just works out well.
Prior to your trips to Antarctica, had you read any of the accounts of the earliest Antarctic explorers?
I can't recall having read them prior to going down there the first time. But of course, when you start going down there, then you definitely start to, or I did, start to read through all the accounts of the early Antarctic explorers, and yeah, I mean, just amazing stories. So. Mm-hmm. Sure. Once you start going down there, you can't help but be fascinated by that. And of course, you know, when you go to McMurdo Station, you have the chance to go out and visit some of the, you know, huts from Shackleton and Scott's expeditions that are still there and preserved. I mean, when you see that, I mean, you can't help but go and dig into the literature on those trips and see what they were up to, see how they were living. I mean, it's fascinating. So, yeah.
Do you see yourself as sort of following in their footsteps in a way, or?
Yeah, I suppose in a way. Yeah, in a way. I mean, you know, when you look at those, some of the accounts of those early trips, and you see people like, you know, Edward Wilson out, collecting meteorological data, and you know, being you know, despite the harsh conditions and the what had to be uncomfortable, pretty uncomfortable living, them still going out and collecting data, doing their measurements, you know, day in and day out. I mean, that's pretty inspiring stuff. And so I guess, yeah, in that regard, even being down there in Antarctica today, it does feel in some ways like you're following in their footsteps.
Earlier we spoke about how Antarctic research has changed over the years since Hal Borns was doing it till now. How do you see the Climate Change Institute itself? How do you think it has evolved in the past 40 years, and where do you think it is now that maybe it wasn't at one time, and where it might be heading in the future?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly grown a great deal, even in the 20 years that that I've been here, not only in terms of just numbers of just numbers, but also in terms of you know, the range of expertise that's here. I mean, one of the hallmarks that the Institute always has been since they started it back in the early 70s is the interdisciplinary nature of it, and that, you know, that theme, I guess, has continued. But I think if you look at the Institute now, there's more disciplines now involved than there was back when the Institute was founded, and that's hopefully that trajectory just continues to grow. I mean, as we you know, the more we learn about the climate system, the more we understand how an interconnected system it really is, and it really requires, you know, climatology, geology, glaciology, you know, meteorology, biology, all these different disciplines really to come together to understand it. And so, you know, hopefully the Institute will continue to grow in that respect, not only in terms of, you know, just numbers and research dollars, which are important, but really grow in terms of the number of disciplines that we include under our umbrella, all sharing this common goal, which is understand the climate system, past, present, and, you know, hopefully future. So that's, you know, I hope to see the Institute continue to grow in that way. And I think it will. And we continue to maintain, you know, some really core strengths that set us apart. I mean, one of them being our focus on ice. I think, you know, ice as a research topic, I think if you look around the country and around the world, there's not many institutions that have such a collection of expertise on some really, you know, a critical mass of people studying ice and its role in the climate system. And you can say the same thing about, you know, in the Institute about, you know, aspects of biology and other things as well, but ice is a really, not only climate, but ice and its role in the climate system is a big strength of the Institute. So I you know, hope to see that continue and grow in the future. Mm-hmm. So,
do you see the growing membership of CCI? Has that in any way made it maybe more difficult to maintain a certain level of cohesion?
Well, I mean, yeah, in some ways, I think. Maybe not cohesion, but just, it certainly makes it more difficult to maintain a feeling of, I don't know what the right word is, I mean, a feeling of closeness, I mean, a feeling that you really know and understand what everyone in the Institute is doing. I mean, I know these days, if I look at the big chart on the wall with all the different pictures, I mean, of course, there's some people I know well and have known well for a long, long time, and then there's some people on there who I probably have never met before. And so, sure, as we grow, that's always going to be a challenge. But, you know, I think it's just up to the Institute to figure out ways to bring people together in ways that everybody can connect. I mean, sure, it's a challenge. I mean, we're scattered around campus. We've got a lot of people now, you know, people in the Institute that are external to campus, and so, you know, it can be tough to maintain that sort of close feeling. But I think it's important. I mean, that's one of the things when I think about back to when I first got involved in the Institute back in the early 90s. I still have memories of, or have a sense that the Institute it was smaller, but it seemed, you know, tight. It seemed like a tight knit group back then. I mean, you had faculty, staff, all together, particularly on the field trips, and you know, all these kids were running around, and everybody just seemed to be more of a family on these field trips. And I'm saying this back then when I was viewing it as a graduate student, but it seemed like, you know, it was almost like a family group out on a field trip rather than just sort of disparate people around campus having to be come together for a short period of time. You know, now as the Institute has grown, I'm not sure that the same, I would get the same sense from the Institute anymore, and maybe that's just because it's much bigger than it used to be, but you know, things change. Back then, you know, with the core group of faculty that started the Institute, they were still, you know, the Institute wasn't much bigger than that core group back when I first got involved, and now it's grown and gotten more diffuse, and that's part of the growth process. But I think if the Institute is smart and just figures out ways to keep people connected in meaningful ways, then hopefully we can, you know, keep that together. Because it is a strength of the Institute, is that it is a group that has overlapping research interests, but also, you know, it's just a good group of people. I think, you know, if you talk to people in other departments, other places, I mean, that's not always the case, that you have a cohesive group of people that enjoy each other and get along and also do good research together. So it's important to maintain that.
What do you see as the Institute's greatest contribution to climate science?
Probably, I mean, in a general sense, the recognition that the climate, you know, it really, over the past, let's say 2 million years, there really has been this interaction between physical climate, biology, and people, and everything, nothing is... has existed in isolation. That the climate system, as we know it, has evolved for a number of different reasons. But there's been all these different interactions along the way that are really difficult that you can't separate out. And so I think that's probably, in many ways, it's the approach of the Institute that is its most important contribution. In other words, approaching the climate system from this interdisciplinary way of looking at climate, biology, people together as sort of one unified thing in the past, and trying to understand it from that perspective, I think that's probably the biggest contribution. I mean, then, you know, from there you can go and look at you know, more specific examples of the contribution, understanding abrupt climate change and abrupt climate change impact on humans and biology, and, you know, there's many, many, I'd say, second order contributions that are really important. But it's this overarching theme and the way that the Institute has approached the problem, I think, that to me is the most important contribution that we've made.
Would you say that sets it apart from other schools of climate science?
It definitely does. I mean, there are other programs out there. When I think about programs, let's say around the U.S., I mean, there are some programs that I mean, many people recognize the value of interdisciplinary science. I mean, it's not like something that only happens here. I mean, many people recognize that. But a lot of places who focus on climate, you know, there's not many that have such an interdisciplinary approach. I mean, a lot of places will, they're studying climate, it'll be some small, you know, they'll be really strong in meteorology, but you know, and that's it, or oceanography, or, you know, some narrow, more narrow focus, but there aren't many that integrate so many different aspects of climate science together in the way that we do here. So it's not unique, but we're one of the few that do it this way, for sure.
Do you know of any others offhand?
Well, I mean, you can look at places like the University of Colorado Boulder. I mean, they have what's called the Institute for Arctic and Alpine Research, which, you know, has had strong ties with our institute going back to Hal's, you know, Hal and George and their original days. They have a similar, interdisciplinary approach. The University of Washington, for example, has an institute for, they still call it the Institute for Quaternary Research. So, same broad ideas, but I think our institute probably, in terms of integrating, again, the physical, the biological, and the human elements together, we're one of the few that do it as well as this. So, yeah.
Sort of a follow-up to a question I asked earlier. What do you see as your own most important contribution to climate research?
Well, I have spent my career, thus far anyway, really focused on looking at a particular time in the Earth's history, and that's the last 1,000 years. So we call it the late Holocene. And it's an interesting time in the Earth's climate history because we went through both a warm period back around 1,000 years ago and then into a cooler time period called the Little Ice Age, and then came out of the Little Ice Age into our modern climate that we have now. And we're still grappling with why that happened. I mean, why did the Earth, because if you look at things like the greenhouse gas concentration in the atmosphere, the amount of energy we get from the sun, different things that we know have an impact on the Earth's climate system, none of those changed a great deal over the past 1,000 years, and yet the Earth went through these fairly significant swings in climate. And so we still, as a community, are trying to understand what really has happened over the past 1,000 years. So I've dabbled in a lot of different things, but I've maintained my research focus on that time period and really trying to understand the evolution of climate and how and why it changed like it did over the past 1,000 years. So I think the data and ideas, findings that I'd be able to contribute to that problem probably have been my most significant contribution to date.
So the issue of climate change in the last 1,000 years, particularly over the last 400 years or so, what are your thoughts on the so-called climate change debate?
In terms of, how do you mean?
Well, in American political culture, the issue of climate change and whether or not humans played a role in that is still up for debate, even though in the scientific community it's not.
Yeah.
What might account for that, that little discrepancy there?
It's a good question. I mean, I think people, the biggest issue to me is the lack, I guess, of appreciation for the scientific method that exists. The scientific community has, for the better part of 40 or 50 years, put a lot of effort into understanding the Earth's climate system. Our understanding is not perfect by any stretch, but we've learned a great deal about how the climate system operates today, over the past several thousand years, hundreds of thousands of years ago, you know, what have you. And there's some basic things that we understand quite well. And it's somewhat, I don't know what the word is, disconcerting, disappointing that people are willing to just disregard all that knowledge and almost come up with their own, what they think are facts on the issue. So I think that's, you know, and that stems from perhaps a lack of understanding about the way that science works, that actually, you know, what we know is built on ideas, collecting data, refining ideas over and over again until, you know, you end up in a place where you have some certain understanding, and you can't just wipe all that away just by saying, well, I don't believe that to be true. You know, that's not the way that science works. It might be the way that politics works, in that, you know, the loudest voice or the most convincing voice or what have you tends to get the most attention or win people's attention. But, you know, that's not the way that the scientific method works. And so to me, it's somewhat disappointing that in this whole debate about the climate system that is so easily, seems like it's so easily overlooked. I don't have any great ways to solve that problem other than, I mean, I don't have any immediate ways to solve that problem, but the way, the best thing that I think I personally can do about it is to address it through teaching, through education. So, you know, I feel fortunate that my position here at the university, my appointment is not only in research, but also includes a teaching component. And so I teach classes, undergraduate and graduate classes, but I teach undergraduate classes in School of Earth and Climate Sciences from at all levels, 100, 200, 300, and 400 level classes. And that's one of the biggest things that, you know, that we work on in my classes. It's not just data and scientific techniques. Yes, that's all important, but really appreciation for the scientific method and the way it works and how to use data and evidence as part of arguments. And so it doesn't, you know, whatever argument it is, whether it's, you know, the issue of whether global warming is real and whether humans are causing climate change or something, you know, much smaller and more esoteric scientific idea. But the idea of making an argument based on data and evidence is the same no matter what you're doing. So so that's that, to me, that's the seems like to me right now that's the most concrete contribution I can make to that issue is to address what I see as the root of the problem through my classes and education. I probably won't, you know, how many students do I connect with? Well, classes are fairly small here, but it's something, you know. So, and there are other people in our institute who are really good at, you know, interacting with the broader public on this issue. And so I think by coming at it from a number of those different angles, we do eventually make a contribution to the issue, hopefully.
What, in your view, actually needs to be done, assuming everyone in the American public bought into the idea of human-caused climate change, there would still be the issue of needing to do something about
sure.
it. What do you think needs to happen?
I think we need to... well, okay, so assuming everybody bought into the... bought into the idea, I think we're going to need to figure out how to not use carbon, you know, go to a carbon-free society. I mean, that's the root of all our problems is putting carbon, so much carbon up into the atmosphere. And so, you know, that's a transitioning to an economy based on carbon-free energy. Well, that's the biggest way to start. I mean, obviously, I know this is such a, you know, it's a huge. It's easy to just say that, but that's where we have to, you know, it's where we have to go. There's no question about that. So if everybody bought into it, even if everybody bought into it, it'd still be a major challenge. But you know, there's a lot of encouraging starts being made. And we just got to keep going in that direction.
All right. Well, thank you. That was all the questions I had. Before we conclude the interview, I'd like to give you an opportunity to add anything you'd like that I didn't ask about.
I can't think of anything really to add. I mean, since we're celebrating other than the fact that, you know, for celebrating the 40th anniversary of the Institute, then I just really think that is a great thing to celebrate. The Institute has, I mean, the Institute has been a huge part of my life. Like I said, I mean, I came here back, you know, well, 21 years ago, I started in the Institute as a young graduate student, and, you know, really have been a part of it ever since then. And, you know, I think the legacy of the Institute is not just about, you know, where it is, where the Institute itself is today and how it's growing and who's part of it. I mean, one of the biggest things about the Institute is the proliferation of the students that have come from here. I mean, I'm not unique here. There are other people, faculty here today who were students and graduate students and stayed at, you know, for are now still part of the Institute, but we have lots of, around the country and around the world, lots of colleagues that I still work with who were students here at the Institute. So the Institute and what Hal and George and both Georges, you know, the core group that started the Institute, the impact that they have had is not just, I think, where the Institute itself is right now, but just, you know, if you look around at all the different students that have gone out and had an impact in science. I mean, it's pretty profound. So, I mean, the 40th anniversary is a great time to celebrate not only, you know, what's the Institute itself and what's here today and how it came to be, but also just the impact that it's had in other places as well. There's a lot of good CCI students out there who are doing a lot of good work that owe a lot of that to the Institute and the start that they gave them. So yeah, it should be a great celebration.
Yep. So, all right. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Before I stop the recording, I would like to note that today is August 15th, 2013. I forgot to indicate that at the beginning of the interview.